little bit of an obscure topic for us to talk about. But I hope that we will appreciate the fact, after we have studied for a while today, that the various accounts in the Old Testament, in Genesis, Exodus, and Joshua, where reference is made to Joseph and his remains, his bones, it's a story about waiting. It's a story about trust in God's promises. Ultimately, it is a lesson about faith. We're going to be looking this morning at the three texts that you see there in Genesis chapter 50, where we will find ourselves near the end of Joseph's life. In Exodus chapter 13, where we find the children of Israel generations later leaving the land of Egypt. And then finally in Joshua chapter 24, where now the deed is done and Joseph's remains are buried as he had instructed. It is a lesson about faith. And I would like for us to begin, before we go to those passages, in the book of Hebrews. In chapter 11, great chapter about faith, about the heroes of faith that the writer of Hebrews brings to our attention. He says this in verse 22 about Joseph, that by faith Joseph, when he was dying, made mention of the exodus of the sons of Israel and gave orders concerning his bones. I don't know about you, but when I read that verse, and when you first read that verse at least, before you explore and think about it, it seems a little bit anticlimactic. It seems a little bit out of place in a chapter in which the writer is calling attention to faith. And he has said things about different heroes of faith. He has talked about the faith of Abraham in more than one way, perhaps the greatest of which he demonstrates his faith when God tells him to take his beloved son Isaac and offer him, the son of promise, and he demonstrates his faith. We see many great examples. But we might ask ourselves, as the writer wants to say something about Joseph, what could he have said about Joseph? More importantly, what could he have said about Joseph that would be consistent with this great chapter that's devoted to faith, teaching us lessons about faith, teaching us lessons from the great men and women of old to help inspire us to have greater faith? What could he have said about Joseph? What he says about him focuses on some of Joseph's dying words. And maybe that ought to give us an idea already, because we often think of some of the most important things that an individual might say often are the things that the person says when they're near death, and they know they're near death. The last words that they have here upon this earth, parting words, words that are given as challenges and charges to those who will carry on. Those are often important words, aren't they? And so he calls attention to Joseph's dying words. And, you know, they have left Egypt behind. They are looking for the promised land. That's what we're going to see in these texts. Someone said that, in summary of what we're going to talk about this morning, that in consequence of Joseph's instructions, the coffin with his bones become a standing exhortation to Israel, an exhortation to turn its eyes away from Egypt to Canaan, to the land promised to its fathers, and to wait in the patience of faith for the fulfillment of the promise. Yes, this is a lesson about faith. It's a lesson about patience, patiently waiting to see the fulfillment of promises that God has made. And so we ought to ask the question, well, what is faith? And here in Hebrews chapter 11, the chapter begins a very familiar text about faith, where he says in verse 1, "Now faith is the assurance of things hoped for, the conviction of things not seen, for by it the men of old gained approval." We could spend an entire lesson just talking about the statements that are made there in those two verses and how the writer elucidates that and illustrates that principle. But suffice it to say here, there are certain key elements of faith that come out in this definition, if you will. One is, he says that faith is the assurance or the substance of things hoped for. So everything that we hope for, everything that we look forward to, is built on the foundation of faith. The word that's translated here, assurance, is sometimes translated substance, some of our English translations. The idea is that which stands under and supports. And so faith is what stands under and supports hope. You know, hope is just wishful thinking if it's not based upon reality. Hope means nothing if we don't have faith to support it, to undergird it, to be the substance of it. So he says faith is the substance of the things hoped for. And then he says that faith is the conviction of things not seen. Evidence is another way that's often translated. That is, that faith is the faith that we can have in God and in His teachings and His promises is not a blind faith. It's not something where we close our eyes and jump and hope for the best. It's faith that's based upon promises. It's faith that's based upon something that we can wrap our minds around and we can have conviction and we can believe in something that's real. And so we have evidence all around us of God. The heavens declare the glory of God. We see evidence all around us of the reality of Jesus Christ as the Son of God, the greatest of which is His resurrection from the dead that we have thought about today. All of those things stand as evidence to say to us that it is more reasonable for us to believe in God, it's more reasonable for us to believe in Jesus Christ than not to believe. And so that's the nature of faith. And then he says, by faith, the men of old gained approval. Much of what you have in Hebrews 11, as you know, we see examples of what faith prompted people to do. How it caused them to act in certain ways and to respond in certain ways to God's commands, to God's direction. And so they lived by faith. They walked by faith. And so he says more than once in this chapter, they gained approval. That is, they gained the testimony from God. That God gave the testimony that He was pleased with them. And that was because of their faith. And so to summarize that, I would say, as you see on the slide here, that there are three things for us to think about when we think about faith. One is that it is the conviction of the mind. Second, it is the trust of the heart. And then third, it is the surrender of the will. I want us to think about those three things in connection with the story of Joseph's bones. And I want you to bear with me. I want you to follow as we think about this. Think about these three aspects of faith. Think about your faith. Think about the faith that we have as children of God, as Christians, where we live now. That faith is the conviction of the mind, the trust of the heart, and the surrender of the will. We think, first of all, about faith being conviction. It's conviction that we can have in our minds. I ask you now to go back to Genesis chapter 50. So at the very end of the book of Genesis, the very end of the book, and Joseph is 110 years old. He is near the end of his life, and he knows that he is. And it says in verse 24 that Joseph said to his brothers, "I am about to die, but God will surely take care of you and bring you up from this land to the land which He promised on oath to Abraham, to Isaac, and to Jacob." And then Joseph made the sons of Israel swear, saying, "God will surely take care of you and you shall carry my bones up from here. And so Joseph died at the age of 110 years, and he was embalmed and placed in a coffin. It is just fascinating to me that space is given here in the record of Genesis. In fact, Genesis closes in this way. This is the epitaph. This is the conclusion of this story that Moses, by inspiration, has left for us. And what it concludes with is Joseph says, when we get to that promised land, whenever that is, take my remains, take my bones there with you. Why does he do that? Why would Joseph focus on that at the end of his life? Why does he include that in his closing words and his final words, the wish that he has, the desire that he has, the communication? Why does he communicate that? I submit to you this morning that it is because he knew that God had spoken. And there is really no other way for us to imagine Joseph saying such a thing as this, except for us to recognize that Joseph implicitly believed that what God had promised, God would fulfill. That they would someday go to that land, that promised land, that his people would receive that promise that God had made. And Joseph does not believe this based on some emotion. This is not just a feeling. This is not just an optimism, a false optimism of some kind, an optimistic feeling. It's based on fact. It's based on reality. It is based on his firm conviction in the reality that God is. His faith is in God, faith in his nature as a God who is always true to his word, whose character is based on righteousness and holiness, and whose will is always pure, and whose will and instructions for his people is always for their best well-being. That's what he believes. That's what he knows in his mind about God, because God has promised. But I would also submit to you that when Joseph makes that statement, and he says to the sons of Israel, he makes them swear, saying that God will take care of you. I know that. And he says, you shall carry my bones up from here. That in Joseph's mind, in his thinking, must be those great promises that God made to his forefathers, first to Abraham. You remember that back there in Genesis chapter 12, when God first called Abram, he calls him to go into the land that he would show him, to leave his country and his relatives and his father's house and go to the land that I'll show you. Think about the faith that Abraham had to have to leave everything, to leave his relatives, to leave what was familiar to him and set out on a journey. He had no road map. He had no GPS. In fact, the Lord didn't even tell him where he was going. He says, I'll show you later. Well, which direction do I go? I don't know. I'm just going to start going, and the Lord's going to show me where. Think about the faith that he must have had for that. But he says to him, I will make you a great nation, and I will bless you, and I will make your name great, and so you shall be a blessing, and I will bless those who bless you, and the one who curses you I will curse, and in you all the families of the earth shall be blessed. So Abraham went forth as the Lord had spoken to him at the age of 75, and he departed from Haran up in Mesopotamia, all of his family and his possessions, and they came to the land of Canaan. Verse 6 tells us that they passed through as far as the site of Shechem to the oak of Moreh, and the Canaanite was in the land. And the Lord again appeared to Abram and said, to your descendants I will give this land, right where you're standing. Well, Abraham, you have arrived. This is where I was leading you. Now stop and look around. Take it in. Soak it up. See what's here. Because this is the land that I promised to you when I told you to leave. This is the land. And he says, I will give this land to your descendants. So he built an altar there to the Lord who had appeared to him. Well, this, of course, comes several times in the Genesis account, doesn't it? Several times God repeats this to Abraham. If you come to chapter 15 and read a little bit there in verse 5, at the time, and he's about to promise to Abraham that he's going to have a son. He says in verse 5, he took him outside and said, "Look toward the heavens and count the stars, if you're able to count them." And he said to him, "So shall your descendants be." Then he believed God, and he reckoned it to him as righteousness. And he said to him, "I am the Lord who brought you out of Ur of the Chaldeans to give you this land to possess it." And he said, "Well, O Lord, how may I know that I will possess it?" So he said to him, "Bring me a three-year-old heifer and three-year-old female goat and a three-year-old ram and a turtle dove and a young pigeon." He brought these out and he offered them to the Lord. And you know, the rest of that story was a demonstration that God provided to assure Abram of his word and of his promise. He had made promises and he was going to fulfill those promises. And then we come a little bit further in that chapter, then down to verse 18. After all this ceremony has taken place, he says to him in verse 18, "On that day the Lord made a covenant with Abram, saying, 'To your descendants I have given this land, from the river of Egypt as far as the great river, the river Euphrates.'" So this is the land, Abram. This is going to be for your descendants. And then one more that I think is worth mentioning in the life of Abraham, of course, is chapter 22, when God told him to take his son Isaac. Now he has that son, the son of promise, and he tells him to do the unthinkable. You know the story well. Go and offer him as an offering. And of course, he did just as God told him to do, and through God's grace and through God's intervention, Isaac was spared. And then he said, "By myself I have sworn, declares the Lord, because you have done this thing and have not withheld your son, your only son. Indeed, I will greatly bless you, and I will greatly multiply your seed as the stars of the heavens and as the sand which is on the seashore, and your seed shall possess the gate of their enemies. And in your seed all the nations of the earth shall be blessed, because you have obeyed my voice." The promise is repeated again and again. And Abraham is being reminded various times in his life of the promise that God has made, the nation that would come from his descendants, the land that they would be given. And of course, this one great part of the promise that looks far into the future, that in your seed all nations of the earth shall be blessed, a blessing to come to all mankind as a result of the promise that God made to Abraham. And we know, of course, then that this promise was so important that it's repeated to Abraham's son Isaac in Genesis chapter 26. And it's repeated again to his grandson Jacob in Genesis chapter 35. And you can read those passages and see that again, this promise was something now that took on a life of its own. And I trust and I'm confident that this did not stop with Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, because now it's part of the consciousness of this family. It's part of who they are as a people. It's something that's going to be in their minds as they move forward. We know that's true because of what Joseph says when he's about to die. "When you get to that promised land, I want you to take my bones there." See, you see that? I want you to think about that. But you see, this is the conviction of the mind. This, I believe, is what is motivating Joseph. That's why he is singled out along with these others as a great example of faith. It's the conviction that we have in the promises of God and the conviction that God can do what He's promised to do. It's like what the Apostle Paul wrote to Timothy in 2 Timothy 1 and verse 12, where he says, "For this reason I also suffer these things, but I'm not ashamed, for I know whom I have believed, and I am convinced that He is able to guard what I have entrusted to Him until that day." Please notice that the Apostle Paul says, we're looking forward to something, we're waiting for something, and we believe implicitly that God will fulfill exactly what He has promised. And so we trust in God. There's the trust of the heart. So I invite you now to turn over to the book of Exodus chapter 13. And in Exodus chapter 13, Moses has delivered his message to Pharaoh, "Let my people go." God has sent a series of calamities, of great plagues upon the land of Egypt, culminating in the death of the firstborn in every family in the land. And the Passover that the children of Israel were called upon to observe, to spare them, to deliver them from that plague, but also to serve as a promise and indication that God is going to fulfill His promises. And so they're delivered from Egypt, and Moses is leading the people now. Pharaoh finally gives in, and at least for a while, and the people set out. And so in Exodus chapter 13, verse 19, the text tells us that Moses took the bones of Joseph with him. For he had made the sons of Israel solemnly swear, saying, "God will surely take care of you, and you shall carry my bones from here with you." You think about this. Here they are, they're setting out, this great throng of people now. They've grown into this great nation, really. A nation emerged in Egypt during the captivity. And I want you to think about the time that has passed. Much time has passed since Joseph made his request. Some four centuries have passed since the promises were first given to Abraham, to the time that now they are leaving this land of bondage. And think about the fact that the people of God have faced trials. Trials that have tested their faith. Surely their faith in God's promise. They've been put to the test. And Exodus opens in chapter 1 with the statement that there arose a king in Egypt who did not know Joseph. And now the Pharaohs had no regard at all, had no respect, had no concern or consideration for Joseph. He was a name from the long past. Had no consideration or respect for the favors that had been given to his relatives, the children of Israel. And certainly no regard or even knowledge of the promises that God had made. And so they face a period of time in their history, a very bitter time, where Exodus, early chapters tell us that the people had grown so numerous that the Egyptians, on one hand, wanted to take advantage of that. So they appointed taskmasters over the people and afflicted them with hard labor. And they subjected them to slavery, enslaved servitude. And in fact, it did this in a very heavy-handed way. They made their lives bitter with hard labor in mortar and bricks and all kinds of labor in the field. And all their labors, which they rigorously imposed on them. These were hard times for the children of Israel. But the Pharaoh was also very concerned, because it seemed that the more burden was placed upon them, the more they multiplied. And they're concerned that they're multiplying and that they are growing. And, they might become a threat to us. They might rise up and fight against us someday. And so now you remember that Pharaoh now begins this campaign, if you will, to wipe out all of the young males who were born in the land. They were facing trials, and they find themselves in Egyptian bondage. Joseph's bones were there with them throughout. And so in chapter 2, we read about the birth of Moses. We know from the Bible a lot about the story of Moses as a baby. We know about Pharaoh's insidious program to exterminate the newborn babies in the land, the Hebrew baby boys. We know about how Moses' mother, his birth mother, placed him in a wicker basket, hid him among the reeds and by the banks of the Nile. We know about how he's rescued and grows up in the house of Pharaoh's daughter. The text tells us about all of that. We know how his true birth mother was able to nurse the child, allowing for Moses to stay in contact with his true parents, the parents who would know about the promises, the parents who would know about Yahweh, the one true God, the Lord. The parents who would instill in this child a faith in those promises and an awareness of who he was and what his heritage, what constituted his heritage, even though he grew up in the house of Pharaoh's daughter. I wonder what Amram and Jochebed would talk to Moses about when he was growing up, when they had the opportunity to talk with the boy. What did they talk to him about? I would submit to you that at the top of the list must have been the promises of God, the promises that had been made to their fathers, this hope that they had as a people chosen by God, a people that God was going to bless because they had made the promise to Abraham and Isaac and Jacob, and probably told him about the story of Joseph. Probably told him about how Joseph, this generation, the last generation that we read about in Genesis, how Joseph, when he was about to die, said, "Take my bones when you go to the promised land." I would suggest to you that all of that was instilled in the heart and mind of Moses. So the text tells us here in Exodus chapter 13 that Moses took Joseph's bones when they left Egypt. You think about that. Think about this throng of people then leaving Egypt and all the things they had to be concerned about as they're leaving that land. They're worried, looking over their shoulder, worried about the Egyptian army that's chasing them all the way as far as the Red Sea. And there was that coffin. Joseph's coffin. I just imagine that just must have been a constant reminder to them. A physical presence, a physical reminder. Don't forget that the Lord has promised us something. There's something waiting for us. There's something we're striving for, something we're living for. When they crossed the Red Sea, there was that coffin going across with them. When God gave His law at Sinai and made a covenant with them, down there at the foot of the mountain in the camp was the coffin with the bones of Joseph. And yes, even when they murmured and complained and brought God's anger and wrath upon them, there was that coffin that should have been a reminder to them that that was not appropriate. When God provided bread from heaven and water from the rock to sustain them in yet another difficult time as they wandered in that wilderness, nearby was that coffin that reminded them of God's promises. And then when God finally led them in victory to possess the land, the promised land, yes, there was the coffin, contained the bones of Joseph. You see, the people had to have not only a conviction of the mind, they had to trust. They had to trust in God. And that's what faith ultimately leads us to do, is to trust in God. Even when it's difficult, even when life is hard, even when all the trials and the circumstances and challenges of life want to make us do otherwise, we trust even in the unseen because of God's promises. But faith also involves the surrender of the will, surrendering our will to God's, and that's an act of faith. When we turn to the book of Joshua, then, in Joshua chapter 24, right near the end of the book of Joshua. Now, this is after the children of Israel have come to the land of Canaan, and they have engaged in various campaigns, both in the north and in the south. Joshua, as their commander leading them, but always with the awareness that it was Yahweh, it was Jehovah, the Lord, who was leading them in the conquest of this land. And so much of Joshua is about the conquest and about how he says not one of the promises that God had made failed. All those statements are found there near the end of Joshua. You know, the promises God made about the nation that was fulfilled, the promise that God made about the land that was fulfilled. And we're reminded of that when we get to the end of Joshua, because that's what it's about. But notice what happens here now in verse 32. Now they buried the bones of Joseph, which the sons of Israel brought up from Egypt at Shechem, in the piece of ground which Jacob had bought from the sons of Hamor, the father of Shechem, for 100 pieces of money, and they became the inheritance of Joseph's sons. So they buried Joseph's bones in Shechem. Shechem, located in the very heart, the very center of the land of Canaan. Not somewhere on the periphery, not just nearby. No, in the very heart, in the very center of the land of Canaan. Not only that, Shechem, you may recall, was the first place where Abraham stopped after he left Haran and he began his sojourn. He stopped there in Shechem, and the promise was repeated, "Here you are, Abram, this is the land that I will give to your descendants as an everlasting possession. This is the land." And now, generations later, Joseph's remains are brought back there, and he's buried there. It was also here that Jacob, in Genesis chapter 33, purchased a parcel of ground. Now they have possessed the very land that God had promised. They have possessed the land under the leadership of Joshua, and they buried Joseph's bones there in the very place where God had promised as their inheritance. You see, their faith was in God's promise. And so they had their conviction in God, and they trusted God. But not only that, they persevered. And they waited. And they waited patiently. And they waited patiently on God to fulfill His promise. And it took a great deal of determination to do that. It took a disposition of the people to say, "Yes, I surrender my will to the will of Almighty God, no matter what happens, because of what He has promised." The nation promise has been fulfilled. The land promise has been fulfilled. Only the promise of the seed was still to come. Here's another statement that I ran across, which I think is a good summary statement of what we've talked about today that I'll share with you. The book of Genesis began with the brightness and glory of God's original creation. All that He did was pronounced good, and the earliest earth was a divine masterpiece. However, sin entered the picture, and the book ends not with man in a beautiful garden, but with the bones of Joseph in a coffin. His coffin is a grim reminder of the effects of sin. But just as Joseph was hopeful and optimistic when he died, so we rejoice in the redemption which God has provided. And while our bones may rest in the wilderness of a cursed earth, they will one day be resurrected, and there will be a new heaven and a new earth. You see, like the children of Israel, we are waiting. We are waiting. That's what our faith is all about. We are waiting. And we wait because of what God has promised. We believe the promises because of the fact that God made the promises, and we are assured in the promises because of all the things that God has done up until now that demonstrate that He is a God who always fulfills His promise. And so we wait. We wait. in a sense, that summarizes who we are as children of God, as Christians, when we're converted. There's a statement that's found at the very end of 1 Thessalonians chapter 1, when the Apostle Paul is writing to the church in Thessalonica. And here's what he says about them. He says, "For they themselves report about us what kind of a reception we had with you, and how you turned to God from idols to serve a living and true God, and to wait for His Son from heaven, whom He raised from the dead, that is, Jesus, who rescues us from the wrath to come." That's a good summary of what it means to be converted to Jesus Christ. Turn to God, to serve Him, and to wait for His Son. And we've turned to God. Those in this audience this morning, we're here and rejoicing and praising God because there was a time in our lives where we confessed our faith that Jesus is the Son of God, and we obeyed Him by going to the waters of baptism. And now we serve. Now we serve. We go about our lives striving to serve God, trying to do His will, trying to live in a way that's good and righteous. But the other thing that we do is that we wait. You see, it's all about faith, and it's about faith supporting our hope. We wait and we hope. When Peter preached that sermon on the day of Pentecost in Acts chapter 2, he makes the statement there that David's tomb is with us to this day, but not Christ's. See, what's so amazing about that day and that statement is, yes, David's bones are still there, but the tomb that Jesus was buried in is empty because He arose. And I close with a reading of what Paul wrote at the end of 1 Corinthians chapter 15. A great chapter about the resurrection. And of course, when it's about resurrection, then it's about victory. Let's just read a few verses here near the end, starting in verse 50. And following this, we'll stand. We're going to sing the invitation song and make an opportunity available for anyone who would like to respond to the gospel invitation and make your life with the Lord what it needs to be. 1 Corinthians 15, verse 50. "Now I say this, brethren, that flesh and blood cannot inherit the kingdom of God, nor does the perishable inherit the imperishable. Behold, I tell you a mystery. We will not all sleep, but we will all be changed in a moment, in the twinkling of an eye, at the last trumpet. For the trumpet will sound, and the dead will be raised imperishable, and we will be changed. For this perishable must put on the imperishable, and this mortal must put on immortality. But when this perishable will have put on the imperishable, and this mortal will have put on the immortality, then it will come about the saying that is written, 'Death is swallowed up in victory.' O death, where is your victory? O death, where is your sting? The sting of death is sin, and the power of sin is the law. But thanks be to God, who gives us the victory through our Lord Jesus Christ. Therefore, my beloved brethren, be steadfast, immovable, always abounding in the work of the Lord, knowing that your toil is not in vain in the Lord." And so we wait, and we will wait. We'll continue to wait through faith for God to fulfill His promise. We wait for Jesus to return, and we look forward to that Sabbath rest that awaits us. Let's stand now as we offer the invitation. King of my life.